Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition. On our program, funding for safe drinking water in Valley communities, where will it come from? There is oil deep beneath the Central Valley, but the method for extracting it, called fracking, is at the heart of an environmental debate. And Fresno Unified has adopted an alternative approach to discipline called restorative justice. We will discuss how it works. But first, the State Water Board drafted recommendations to address nitrate pollution in groundwater and presented them to the legislature earlier this year. One of the main recommendations is to create a new funding source to provide safe drinking water to poor, disadvantaged communities. Now growers, affected community members, and legislators are debating where that funding should come from. FM 89's Rebecca Plevin has the story.
For the past 35 years, Sandra Garcia has picked grapes, plums, and peppers on San Joaquin Valley farms. But when she returns to her home in the small Tulare County community of Poplar, she's reminded of agriculture's impact on her drinking water. She can't drink it because it contains unhealthy levels of nitrates. And she can't cook with it because boiling water can concentrate the nitrate level. It's a serious health issue for infants and pregnant women. On a recent morning, Garcia flipped on the filter on her faucet. She uses the filtered water mainly when she's washing dishes or cooking. She pays about $27 every couple months for the filter. On top of that, she pays about $50 a month for tap water, which she can't use for much besides bathing or laundry. She also spends about $50 a week on bottled drinking water.
When they send us the advisory that our water has pesticides or nitrates or has something else in it, time has already passed since they realized it. We don't know when we can drink the water and when we can't drink it, so we never drink the water. We're always buying water.
Garcia is among more than 250,000 people in the Tulare Lake Basin and the Salinas Valley who are at risk for nitrate contamination of their drinking water. That's according to a UC Davis report that was submitted to the legislature last year. The report also found that agriculture fertilizers and animal waste applied to cropland were the source of an estimated 96% of nitrate pollution in groundwater in these areas. In a February report to the legislature, the State Water Resource Control Board recommended several ways to address the issues associated with nitrate-contaminated groundwater. John Borkovich is the Groundwater Ambient Monitoring and Assessment Program Manager at the State Water Resource Control Board's Division of Water Quality. He explains that the board's chief recommendation was to create a new, reliable funding source to help design, build, operate, and maintain safe drinking water systems for small, disadvantaged communities impacted by nitrate contamination.
That's a critical need. That's the number one recommendation, is that ultimately when you get through all of the different issues associated with nitrate contamination to groundwater, we felt that the number one issue was to address the issue associated with people that were drinking water that was not safe.
In its report, the Water Board proposed three possible funding sources to support continuing long-term costs to address safe drinking water issues in the South San Joaquin Valley and the Salinas Valley. One recommendation is to tack a fee onto certain food products, like cheese, purchased at the supermarket. It stems from the fact that nitrogen from animal facilities is a significant source of groundwater contamination. The board also recommended a water use fee. It would apply to all public water rate users. Finally, the board suggested a fee on nitrogen fertilizing materials. The idea is that the extra cost might be an incentive for growers to reduce nitrogen use. But according to the report, it could increase costs for the state's farmers and ranchers. There's also a concern that while the cost of this option would most likely fall on existing farmers, current groundwater nitrate contamination is a result of past agricultural practices. The UC Davis report found this option to be the most promising source of additional revenue.
It's fairly easy to
be able to make that statement, but the realities of putting a fertilizer fee in place are a little bit different.
That's Assemblymember Mark Stone, a Democrat from Monterey Bay. Following the nitrate reports, he authored AB 467, which would create a reliable, stable funding source to provide long-term, safe drinking water infrastructure and short-term solutions for communities impacted by nitrates. The Water Board can't implement any of the recommended fees because they require action from the state legislature. Stone's bill is expected to be heard in the Assembly Appropriations Committee in May. Stone acknowledges the challenges of generating new funds and doing so without overburdening one industry or community. But, he says, a nitrogen fertilizer fee is one of several potential funding sources he's discussing with growers, affected residents, and advocates. He says it could be a component of a larger solution.
From my standpoint, the fertilizer fee is definitely on the table, as is any other possible revenue source that we can get. Certainly very open to minimizing the burdens on any individual sector, but we desperately need to come up with the resources to address the problem.
David Orth is the general manager of the Kings River Conservation District and the co-chair of Governor Brown's Drinking Water Stakeholder Group. He says Central Valley growers want to see the drinking water issues addressed in a fair and equitable way.
Many of today's farmers have made such significant changes and improvements in the way they irrigate and the way they utilize their nitrogen to try to make today's farmer pay for issues that he inherited when he took that farm over are inequitable.
The goal, he said, should be to ensure that various industries and communities are contributing to the solution.
We have to find a balance where ag is investing, where the public is investing, where the customers who receive this water continue to pay just like you and I do for drinking water. I think a balanced portfolio of revenues is the way we solve this problem.
Back in Poplar, Sandra Garcia does not mince words as she describes where she believes the funding for short-term and long-term drinking water solutions should flow from. She's heard about the Water Board's recommendations and has even testified about related bills in Sacramento. From her perspective, the Valley's agriculture community should be part of the solution.
If they are impacting the water, then they should contribute something so the water can be cleaned up. They should do something to support us so we can have good water.
Despite their positions on where the money should come from, everyone seems to agree on the overarching goal, that all Valley residents soon have access to safe, clean drinking water. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Plevin.
Thank you, Rebecca, for that report. Could California be on the verge of a new gold rush? That's the finding of a new study from USC about petroleum deposits that lie deep beneath the Central Valley, known as the Monterey Shale. But extracting that oil isn't easy, and it would require the use of a number of advanced techniques, including hydraulic fracturing. And that's attracted concerns from environmental groups and state regulators. Valley Public Radio's Joe Moore reports on some recent developments in the fracking debate.
Experts say there could be more than 15 billion barrels of oil locked deep within the Monterey Shale Formation under Central California. That's about two-thirds of the entire nation's shale oil reserves, and around four times the amount found in a similar formation in the Dakotas, which is currently fueling a Midwest oil boom. Adam Rose is a research professor in the Price School of Public Policy at USC. Last month, his group released a study that examined the potential economic impact of the Monterey Shale on California through 2030.
The economic potential is immense, and it's not just in the San Joaquin Valley where most of the drilling might take place.
He says the petroleum-rich formation covers over 1,700 square miles in the center of the state, including a good part of the San Joaquin Valley. His study projects that statewide, oil production from the Monterey Shale could create over 2.8 million jobs and grow the state's economy by 14%. It could also be a boon to state and local government, filling coffers with an estimated $4.5 billion. With numbers like that, it's not surprising that the USC report draws comparisons to the California gold rush in more ways than one.
This is something that could be a major boost to the state's economy, and it's not just incremental, but really a dramatic shift, much like a gold rush could be. So it's really a boon to the state. But at the same time, the gold rush did have some negative side effects, environmental, that we still see today.
And according to Rose, for this boom, weighing the possible economic rewards with the potential environmental risks will be essential.
One needs to look at this in a more modern way, and for us to learn from the past. How this pans out depends a lot on the way it's managed.
Part of the problem with the Monterey Shale is that while geologists have known about it for decades, getting to the oil in a cost-effective manner has been difficult.
The shale does not yield up the resource in it, whether it's oil or natural gas, easily.
Tupper Hull is a spokesperson for the Western States Petroleum Association, which helped fund the USC study.
For many decades, it was perceived as a resource that wasn't really available. And then along came a couple of significant technological developments.
They include something called directional drilling, which allows wells to travel horizontally through the richest oil-bearing rock, and hydraulic fracturing, or fracking.
Where fluids with a proppant in it, which is typically sand, gets forced down there at pressures that cause some very small fractures to take place, and therefore releasing that resource.
In addition to water, those fluids also contain chemicals that environmentalists say could contaminate groundwater. What happens to those fluids is a big concern for Brendan Cummings, a lawyer with the Center for Biological Diversity. His group, along with the Sierra Club, filed suit earlier this month to stop fracking operations on 17,000 acres of public land in Fresno, Monterey, and San Benito counties.
Our lawsuit essentially argues that the federal government was required by existing law to fully disclose and analyze the risks presented by fracking. What are the chemicals used? What groundwater bodies may be put at risk by these? What is the relationship between fracking and earthquakes? Where will the water come from to frack these wells?
He says the risks to the environment and human health are real.
The chemicals involved in fracking are something that we're very concerned about, both in terms of the potential of groundwater contamination, as well as the fact that it generates a lot of wastewater.
His organization also supports a bill in the State Assembly by Santa Monica Democrat Richard Bloom that would put a moratorium on fracking in the state until lawmakers develop more regulations to govern its use.
Until and unless the state, the feds, and the industry can really demonstrate that fracking is safe, and until there's some way we can demonstrate that extracting the oil out of the Monterey Shale is somehow compatible with a transition to a renewable energy economy, we shouldn't be fracking at all, and we need to be leaving that oil in the ground.
That bill and two others, which would further regulate fracking, passed their first tests in the Assembly Natural Resources Committee Monday on identical 5-3 votes. They will now go to the Assembly Appropriations Committee. At the same time that lawmakers are looking to slow or halt fracking in the state, the California Department of Conservation is following its own path to develop new regulations for fracking. Under a draft set of guidelines, the state is proposing to tighten some testing and disclosure requirements about where and when wells are fracked. But the rules stop short of full public disclosure of all chemicals used in the process, calling them trade secrets. The oil industry says the concern over fracking is misplaced, saying the practice is time-tested and safe. Tupper Hull.
This is a technology that has been used in conventional oil production in California for 60-some-odd years. And during that time, no one has ever identified a risk to the environment or hazard to the environment. So this idea that this is a technology that has somehow inherent risks or is otherwise exotic really is not an accurate portrayal of the technology.
But Professor Rose from USC admits that when it comes to the Monterey Shale, there are some environmental risks.
We acknowledge there are concerns about water contamination, both in the drilling itself, which is less likely to be significant because you're drilling below the water table, and as long as you have good well casing and cemented well, you should be in good shape, but there is a water disposal problem with the chemicals that are used. There's also the possibility of induced seismicity, meaning the creation of small earthquakes that can potentially pose some problems.
Even with advanced drilling technologies, some in the industry question the predictions of a California shale oil bonanza. They say that the complex geology of the Monterey Shale could make it difficult to recover all of that oil. But John Cox, president of the Communications Institute, which partnered with USC on the study, says that while the risks are there, so is the potential reward, including a big boost to the valley's economy.
What is being raised in California basically involves a four-letter word that starts with the word R, and it's risk. How do we basically deal with the risks to public health and safety while allowing for the constructive economic growth that provides jobs and opportunities for people? And we have become extremely risk-averse in this country.
To what degree California remains risk-averse remains to be seen. But Professor Rose and environmental groups seem to agree more study and analysis will be needed before any 21st century gold rush begins.
The public should insist that not only should there be further study of the economics, but also study of the various potentially negative side effects of this oil development so that the big issue can be assessed properly and wisely on behalf of all citizens of the state.
It's a balancing act that in one way or another could dramatically change the future of the San Joaquin Valley and California. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Joe Moore.
And now some new developments concerning Valley Fever. The dramatic rise in cases of Valley Fever in recent years is now causing big problems in California's prison system. FM 89's Joe Moore reports on why the federal office that runs health care in the state's prisons is ordering some prisoners out of the valley.
The federal receiver in charge of health care in California's prisons is ordering the state to remove inmates from two Central Valley prisons who are especially at risk of contracting the fungal disease known as Valley Fever. The move affects about 40% of the inmate population at Avenal and Pleasant Valley state prisons. Those affected include African Americans, Filipinos, inmates who are HIV positive, have compromised immune systems, or are pregnant or elderly. Joyce Hayhoe is with the Department of California Correctional Health Care Services. She says Valley Fever has been a growing problem in the prison system.
Since 2006, we've had 40 deaths statewide where Valley Fever was either the primary or secondary cause of death. So this is something that, you know, is more than just one or two cases here or there.
She says the state prison system had already taken some steps to reduce the incidence of Valley Fever. They were excluding inmates considered most vulnerable to the disease from prisons in endemic regions like the Valley, were educating prisoners about Valley Fever symptoms, and had canceled planned construction at Pleasant Valley State Prison. But she says those efforts were not enough.
But in data that we have since received, those efforts have really proven to be ineffective.
In an email, Jeffrey Callison, press secretary for the State Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, said the implications of the receiver's directive are, quote, considerable, especially since it's effective immediately. It's unclear exactly how the department will comply with the directive.
There are 31 other state prisons statewide, so our directive does not tell the department where to move them. That is entirely up to the department. And, the department is pretty good at moving prisoners when it's necessary.
Since 2007, a federal receiver has been in charge of health care in the state's prisons after a federal court found inmate conditions unconstitutional. Valley Fever is an airborne fungal disease that is common throughout the arid Southwest and in the San Joaquin Valley. The issue of Valley Fever in state prisons came to light in part through a series of special reports called Just One Breath from the Reporting on Health Collaborative. Valley Public Radio is a member of the project. The relocation issue could complicate the state's efforts to gain a handle on the prison population. Governor Brown has until Thursday to release a plan to further reduce prison overcrowding in California. A federal three-judge panel is threatening to hold the governor in contempt if he fails. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Joe Moore.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Kaiser Permanente Fresno.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you're listening to Valley Edition. The Fresno Unified School Board recently approved a new discipline plan aimed at reducing high suspensions and expulsion rates in the district. Fresno Unified will move to implement restorative justice programs, a discipline policy which includes mediation and counseling, holding students accountable for their actions. It's a program that has been used in juvenile court for years. We talked to Presiding Judge Kimberly Gabe of the Juvenile Delinquency Court in Fresno County about how the program works in the court system. Joining us now is Kimberly Gabe, the presiding judge of the Juvenile Delinquency Court in Fresno County. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, can you explain to us what is restorative justice as it relates to the juvenile court system?
Restorative justice is a program that we have in the juvenile court system. We started it in 2009, and the specific program is called the Community Justice Conference. And the way the program works is the juvenile or the minor admits to the charge or admits to wrongdoing and then goes through a mediation program where the child initially meets with a family member and support individuals with mediators, talks about what's going on in that child's life, and then ultimately meets with the victim and comes to an agreement on what the child can do to make things right. And the victim has the opportunity to participate, and a resolution is reached, and the case is ultimately dismissed.
Now, do the victim and the perpetrator, do they both have to agree to this option?
Yes.
Oftentimes, do you find that victims are more willing to opt for this course?
Usually, once the program is explained to them, victims are very willing to participate. This program right now only applies to misdemeanor offenses, which are more of the low-level offenses. So we're talking about vandalisms, batteries, assaults, burglaries. And the advantages of the program to the victim are that restitution is paid by the offender at 10 times the rate as a person who does not go through the program. So the victim is much more likely to be paid his or her damages than if he or she does not participate in the program. And the victim has some control over of the process, what agreement is going to be reached, and the opportunity to speak with the offender and to try to get through to that individual what the impact that it's had on the victim.
How do the juveniles who've committed the crimes, when they're going through this process, what have you seen as far as how it impacts them and what you believe they get from this process?
Well, what the research has shown and what our past experience has shown is that juveniles who go through this process reoffend at a fraction of the rate that juveniles that don't go through this process reoffend. The reoffense rates for individuals going through the mediation process is right around 5%. For those young people that don't go through it, those rates are more like 25 to 30%. So for most of these individuals, they learn a valuable lesson from the process. We have upwards of a 90% completion rate, meaning that the individuals that go through this process, over 90% successfully complete what they were required to do, pay the damages that are owed, do whatever terms the agreement provides, and don't come back to court.
What do you think this provides for the juvenile? What do you think that they get from this? As far as I think what I'm trying to say is, why do you think this is a good alternative than just the traditional kind of punishment?
Beyond the advantage that this provides for the community, I think for the juvenile, there's a couple of different advantages. One, because of the family mediation component that we have in this program at our court, the juvenile has the opportunity to talk about issues that are going on either at school. For example, let's say the crime was bringing a knife to school. Well, a lot of times young people will say, well, I brought a knife to school because I'm being bullied. So now the family had no idea until they go through this process that this child has been bullied. So it's the opportunity to talk through some issues with the child, with the family, to get that child support people, mentors. They're required to bring beyond family members, a support person, and that can be a teacher, a coach, a clergy person. So they have immediately individuals who know this child is struggling and can provide those services. It also gives the offender the opportunity to speak with the victim and to understand what the juvenile's actions did to that person and how that person was harmed, and to get the victim's perspective. And many times this leaves a lasting impression, particularly on a young person.
It seems to me when they go through this process, I think that's one of the things that came out of the workshop with Fresno Unified, which is now adopting a restorative justice model, is that they find that these young people, they're experiencing a lot of different things in their lives that sometimes cause them to react in a certain way. And so a lot of this, what you're talking about, is parenting or what's going on in the home.
That is absolutely true. And what I think people don't understand and the public doesn't understand is there are so many things going on within this child's environment that's leading to the delinquent behavior. We have very few cases with a child who is in a very stable home, who's going to school, doing well in school, that picks up criminal charges. Usually these young people don't have strong families, don't have parents who are supporting what they're doing, don't have mentors and role models, are often in environments where there's gang influences, and it makes it very difficult for them to avoid some of the criminal behavior.
How would this translate, you think, into a school setting?
I certainly think it is possible to have it translated into a school setting. I think that the advantage to restorative justice is that you look at the big picture. The individuals who are participating in the program have the opportunity to see what's going on in this child's life, and it's beyond just having this disciplinary issue at school or committing this criminal offense. There's so many underlying reasons going on that need to be addressed so that we can make these young people productive members of society and give them a shot going forward as adults. So I think with the restorative program in the school system, it's a more broad-based approach to look at what's going on in that child's life.
And with this kind of program, I think it was even acknowledged with school officials, you know, not every young person is going to be a candidate. And I'm sure you see that in the juvenile court system as well for this, because you talked about just misdemeanor crimes.
Yes, agreed. And the one of the biggest issues with this is you have to take a child who accepts responsibility. If a child is going forward saying, I didn't do anything wrong, or is not willing to accept responsibility, then that child is not a good candidate for this program. This program is about accepting responsibility, honoring agreements, meeting with the victim, apologizing, and being accountable. And if a child is unwilling to do that, then they would not be a good candidate for this program.
Also, what can you say to people? You know, we have developed in our society right now such an attitude of no second chances, of punishment, a swift and quick punishment. So in a situation like that, what do you think we as a society can learn from something like this as far as how we can deal with young people at a certain age to maybe help them really look at other alternatives in their lives?
I think that we as a society need to understand that the money that we pay to incarcerate young people and the money we pay as a society if that young person turns into an adult criminal and is in the system is extraordinary. The cost of this mediation program pales in comparison to the cost that we spend to incarcerate a young person. We spend almost $90,000 a year to have one child in custody at the juvenile justice campus here in Fresno County. We currently have about 320 children who are in custody. That is an extraordinary amount of money to spend to lock up a child, particularly if we're not addressing whatever behavior, whatever things are going on in that child's environment, so that we can get them back on track so that they are not in the adult criminal system. That is the goal of the juvenile court. Unlike the adult court, the goal of the juvenile court is to rehabilitate this young person and get this young person whatever services are required, counseling, school services, work with the student, the child at home, to make sure that we're addressing all that child's needs so that that child does not end up in the adult criminal system.
These are a lot of skills that a lot of young people aren't learning at home.
That's true, very, very much. And we try to give the biggest thing with these children is to get them with mentors and role models and people that can work with them to get them into careers and jobs and vocational training so that they can pursue a future.
And from what I've read, oftentimes when the victim is made aware of a lot of things in this young person's life, they really come away with a whole different view of that young person who committed that offense against them.
Very much so. In fact, we've done surveys, both the offenders and the victims who have gone through the process, and on a 5-point scale, the responses are universally 5 from the victims going through. Would you recommend this program to somebody else? Absolutely. Did you find it beneficial? Absolutely. And we have countless stories of where a victim starts out very upset because there was damage to his or her property. And by the end of it, the victim has had the child come and do work to make it right, to repair the damage. And in the end, the victim has hired the child, once the child turns 18, back into that business because as a 16-year-old, that child did such a good job in the work ethic. And when you give these children the opportunity to make it right and to show that they can do a good job, they can really rise to the occasion.
What kind of agreements do young people have to make going through this program? They are being held responsible for the actions that they took. So on their end, what is it that you require of them, and what do you think they get from this?
The agreements vary. It is an interactive process. The victim has a lot of say on what the agreement is. The child has a lot of say on what the agreement is. Typically, some examples would be a child might agree to do work to clean up whatever was damaged at the business owner's property. The child might agree to pay X number of dollars per month to get to cover the damages that were done. The child often agrees to do things at home. Many times we have children going through this process where their behavior at home has been less than stellar, so they reach agreements with their families on the things that they're going to do at home. They reach agreements on going to school and applying themselves in school and not cutting classes. They often do apology letters, not just to the victim, but to family members. There's a wide range of options as far as the agreement.
And in the end, what do you think they get from this?
What does the child get?
Mm-hmm.
I think the child has, our hope anyway, is that the child has an understanding of what his or her actions did to the victim, an understanding of how the victim was made to feel as a result of this, an understanding of the monetary damages that the victim suffered as a result of this, and an understanding of how that child's behavior has affected his or her family, his or her school, and an appreciation that it was wrong, that it was a serious offense, the opportunity to make it right and to fix what was wrong, and to not do it again.
Okay. Judge Kimberly Gabe, presiding judge, Juvenile Justice Delinquency Court. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, how will restorative justice programs look in the schools? Fresno Unified officials say it will take both time and money to implement a new discipline policy. The district took a lot of time examining its current policies and why they needed to be changed. Joining me to discuss what went into Fresno Unified's decision to embrace a new discipline policy is Ambra Dorsey. She's the Executive Director, Department of Prevention and Intervention for Fresno Unified, and she's also a lawyer. So, Ambra Dorsey, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Now, the Fresno Unified School Board recently voted to embrace that alternative approach to discipline built around restorative justice. Now, we heard Judge Gabe talk about restorative justice in the court system. What might it look like in a school setting?
Well, Juanita, restorative practices in an educational setting respond to disciplinary issues in a restorative manner. Ideally, the process is going to address the root cause of the harm, holding the offender accountable, and should promote healing for all the involved parties. We heard from Judge Gabe, in the juvenile justice arena, restorative justice is primarily focused on responding to a criminal offense. In the school setting, restorative practices will work alongside other programs to create a positive school culture while still maintaining safety. You heard from our board workshop earlier this month that the board did make a clear commitment to pursue this approach as one of the options for addressing student behavior. Moreover, the board expressed support for our superintendent's recommendation to set aside $500,000 to begin programming at a grouping of schools within the district. We're currently in the research and planning stages, going to determine which restorative practices will be implemented and what that will look like in our district. We do anticipate that our Board of Education will consider a resolution at our second board meeting in May, and that that resolution will identify principles of restorative justice to further guide our implementation. Of course, that final allocation of funding will occur with the adoption of our budget for next year, and that should allow us to be in a position to implement programming within the next school year.
Now, the board's decision has been part of a long process. How big of an impact did the graduation task force report have on the discussion of school discipline?
That's a great question. Our graduation task force is a driving force of all of the work in our district. In this particular area, the graduation task force made 16 recommendations that are interrelated to our discipline system. Of those 16, 12 are in the execution or planning phase. Pursuing restorative justice is an example of one recommendation which is in the planning phase. Thanks to the work of our task force and our Board of Education, we are in a position to begin to make this possible.
Now, one of the things, what came out of that report, I think one of the things that I thought was really interesting was the fact of how it impacted student attendance and truancy.
Attendance is a major priority within our district. The task force identified several recommendations related to the improvement of attendance and the reduction of truancy. Our district attendance target is 95%. We want 95% of kids in school every day. Last year, we did end with an average daily attendance just above 94%, and as of March 2013, this year, average daily attendance was at 94.4. In alignment with the recommendations of our graduation task force, our district continues to increase efforts around attendance by improving communication with families, increasing routine monitoring of attendance, allowing teachers to take attendance immediately, first thing in the morning. Simply put, we need to be able to have our kids in school every day to teach them.
I think one of the things that was surprising to me is when you looked at the statistics when it came to suspensions and expulsions and what kind of impact it was having on students. And that does impact learning.
Absolutely. Well, we do know, and the research shows that suspension and expulsion, it keeps kids out of school. So at both the state, national, and local level, we do see kids that are coming out of school. In one year, we had up to 30,000 absences in relation to missed days of school. So we do want to look at approaches which allow to have our kids in school, any discipline approaches which allow them to still remain in school and be learning while still maintaining safety.
But also, you had it broken down, I thought, by ethnicity. We saw some trends with a lot of students when it came to ethnicity, the kinds of students that were being disciplined. And what did that show? I mean, what did that show the district, those numbers?
Well, our district is taking a good look at what are the groups, that are being suspended and expelled at disproportionate numbers, you know, and our district as well as districts nationwide, we're looking at a disproportionality. We do know that there are some subgroups that are being disciplined disproportionately: middle school students, African American students. And also our special education students, we do see suspended and expelled at a higher rate.
What is that? What does that kind of show you when you take a look at those students? To me, when you take a look at it, it just seems to me that there may be some teachers or adults may have certain perceptions about those students. And when you even look at special needs students and the fact that it seems people aren't willing to work with them.
Absolutely. Really, improving our discipline system is about improving relationships with kids, not only with kids in certain target groups, but with all kids. So part of our discipline policy reform this upcoming year is going to look at really making things very consistent and fair for all the groups within our district.
But doesn't a lot of what you have to do, it goes back to the adults and how the kind of relationship that they build with these students?
Absolutely. If you talk to kids who, and we have, you know, graduation task force talked to 1,000 current and former students, they will say that what really helps is to have someone in their school that cares about them. They want to feel connected to their school, and they want to feel connected to the adults in that school community.
So when you talk about restorative justice or implementing a new kind of discipline policy, because I think when you say restorative justice, people just think of one thing, but what you're talking about really are just different methods of how you go about working with students.
Absolutely. Restorative justice is more than just a program. As you heard Judge Gabe, it's a philosophy and a set of principles. So while we may be implementing some programming specifically at a target group of schools, it's going to be about infusing a philosophy and restorative practices within our whole district. For example, instead of suspending for a student who breaks a window, we'll look at restitution. We'll look at allowing the student to make amends. So it's going to be a variety of interventions, and we're networking with our other districts in California to learn how we can roll this out.
Because Fresno Unified isn't the only district that's looking at this, from what I've read. You have other school districts that are looking toward the same model. And what it indicates to me is that maybe a lot of educators have decided that the way that they were disciplining kids just wasn't working.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. We see other large urbans such as Oakland, and also nationwide, there's districts that are in various stages of restorative practices and restorative justice. In addition, other agencies, child welfare is looking into family conferencing and other kind of conflict resolution techniques as alternatives to the traditional punitive system.
Because doesn't research show that suspensions and expulsions kind of contribute to other things?
It does. There's a recent report out of UCLA that said even just one suspension in a student's ninth grade year increases their dropout rate. There's also other research that's talked about incarceration and how discipline at the early ages leads to increased rates of incarceration for our youth.
And one of the things, now nearly so many schools adopted zero tolerance policies. And I think the district adopted theirs in 1994. Mm-hmm. But, you know, one of the things I'd kind of like to look at, and I thought it was very interesting that during the workshop, Superintendent Hansen sort of gave a historical perspective of how districts came to zero tolerance policies and what was going on in the country at that time. And these are some of the things he kind of mentioned, and I'd like to have you react to this, that he said it, the whole thing sort of started in 1994 when Congress passed Gun-Free Schools Act. You also had the war on drugs going on. In 1995, you had the Oklahoma City bombing. And in 1997, you had this horrible case in Sacramento of a student who was sexually assaulted and murdered on campus.
Correct.
By a janitor who was a parolee who hadn't been fingerprinted, and, mm-hmm. and how that led to, you know, fingerprinting employees. He talked about the in 1998, the death of Matthew Shepard, who had been bullied because he was gay. Then, of course, 1999, you had Columbine, the Columbine shootings, and then in 2000, and then you had the 9/11 terrorist attacks. So you take a look at all of this that's going on in the country and people not feeling safe. And a lot of what is happening, you know, in society, people see it as kind of reflective on campus. So that's how this whole zero tolerance policy thing sort of kind of came into being. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. And you are correct. Although the term zero tolerance doesn't appear in the law, you know, it's not a technical term. It did start with the Federal Gun-Free Schools Act back in 1994, and that was a federal law that required school districts to pass what came to be labeled as zero tolerance policies. Initially, those policies were just straight against firearms. schools had to pass it in order to be able to be eligible for federal funds. That act required one calendar year of expulsion for any student who brought a gun to school. Later, California legislature amended our own ed code to include not only possession of a firearm to be a mandatory expulsion, but also other offenses, serious offenses, such as brandishing a knife, sales of drugs, sexual assault, sexual battery. And, you know, given the war on drugs, the public concern about the escalating violence, all the events that you mentioned, it led to school district governing boards adopting zero tolerance policies that included those mandatory offenses. And then also some districts expanded those policies to cover other more common offenses.
What do you think may be some of the challenges of implementing this? You know, in society, there is a train of thought from a lot of people, mainly because of what we've just talked about, who feel like, okay, if a kid does something wrong, he just needs to be kicked out of school. Mm-hmm. How do you kind of answer to that?
You know, that is a group in our society does feel that way. You know, in establishing discipline policies that are fair, always we look at safety. So we have to maintain, we have to make sure that our schools are safe. But while we allow our policies to guide us, we have to recognize that every discipline situation is unique. Each student has their own unique story and their own challenges, and they have circumstances that need to be taken into consideration. Therefore, we can't use a cookie-cutter approach to our student discipline. And we're happy to be reforming our policies because our policies must evolve to address the needs of the people in the community we serve.
Well, what will be the next step for Fresno Unified? As we mentioned, the board just passed this, I think, less than 2 weeks ago. Superintendent Hansen even said this is not going to happen overnight because you're talking about district-wide.
Absolutely. We want to be very thoughtful in our approach. We want to roll this out in the best way for our students. Our work, and we're very excited about our work, is going to continue with an anticipated board resolution later in May, hopefully at the May 22nd meeting. That resolution should outline the principles of restorative justice and guide our work as we move forward. Existing discipline attendance policies and procedures are currently being revised, and our board will adopt those revisions in June. And then we're going to complete an implementation plan to allow us to pilot our restorative practices and programming within a grouping of schools.
When do you think they might start trying to implement that? Because what you're talking about is a process, and it will depend on funding.
Mm-hmm. As long as we get the allocated funding, we're hoping to have an implementation plan in place by summer and that we're actually on the ground with some actions at the start of the school year.
Okay. Thank you very much, Amber Dorsey.
Thank you for having me.
With Prevention and Intervention with Fresno Unified. And next week, we talk about how restorative justice looks in the classroom. We will take a look at Yosemite Middle School. The principal there implemented new discipline methods 3 years ago. And I tell you, I was on campus, and you will be amazed by the result. Next week, the story of Yosemite High School and Principal Ed Gomes. This is Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. Well, we have got a honey of a festival for you this weekend. The Vineyard Farmers Market Association is hosting its Be My Honey Festival, with some of the Central Valley's top chefs whipping up some honey dishes. Joining us to talk more about the festival is Felix Muskies. She is the executive director of the Vineyard Farmers Market Association. Thank you so much for coming in. I hope you don't mind if I call you Felix.
Oh, not at all. Thank you for having me.
How did you come up with the Honey Festival?
Oh, Be My Honey. It just kind of makes itself. No, well, of course, we have longtime vendor at the market, Bee Bob, who has Bee Bob's Honey. And he was the inspiration for one of our other vendors, Poppy Lane Publishing, who publishes local books. She decided to go ahead and commission a storybook to be written about bees dedicated to Bee Bob. So she had this book written by a local author and illustrated by a local artist, Joseph G. Garcia. And it's called The Honey Bee and the Butterfly Tumble Through the Air. And it's a book in rhyme. And so anyway, she had this book published. And so we decided to do a honey festival all around
all
it.
All around the book.
All around the book and Bebop and, of course, our love of honey. So and the chefs all thought it was just a fantastic idea. So this is our third annual Be My Honey Festival.
Well, you know what? I think what would be interesting is really what kind of dishes you come up with using honey. I mean, a lot of people do use honey in a lot of things. They've, you know, substituted it for sugar. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, how do the chefs kind of see this? Is this an opportunity for them to kind of be creative and come up with these different dishes using honey?
Oh, definitely. They really have a fun time. A lot of our events that we do at the market, of course, are all revolve around our local chefs, usually chef-owned restaurants and the restaurants that actually shop at our market. So we have an ongoing relationship with these great chefs that come through. And, of course, they're always inspired by the different things that we have at the market. Everything is so fresh and local and wonderful. So with the honey, they've really done all kinds of wonderful things. Some of the things we'll see this year, I believe, Keith Smith from Keith's Boxcar Cafe will be doing a honey baby back ribs with a honey glaze on it.
We're hungry.
Doug Wakita, who is a James Beard Foundation scholarship recipient, along with Sharon Alexander, who used to run Upstairs Downtown, will be representing Marion Farms, and they're going to do a gluten-free honey panna cotta, which should be just absolutely fantastic. So we have, I mean, it's just, they are all just really talented people that come out, and they really give their all to this event.
Now, what are the chefs in the restaurants who are going to be represented?
I will tell you that. One is Nathan Lewis Copeland, who was formerly with Parma Restaurant. He now has his own establishment, which is Copeland's Catering. He does his own functions now. And then we also have Vache Mukhtarian of Cracked Pepper Bistro, who's always been a great supporter of our market. Jonathan Perkins of Erna's Elderberry House will be there as well. I believe he's going to be doing some sort of duck confit elaborate dish. He's got cooking up there. And then, of course, Keith Smith of Keith's Boxcar Cafe, located downtown Fresno. And then, as I said, Doug Wakita and Sharon Alexander will be representing Marion Farms.
So people will get a chance to taste these dishes.
Yes.
And by the way, the Vineyard Farmers Market is great. It's always been wonderful.
Thank you very much.
You know, one of the things that people might think about is that, you know, there's been in the news this whole situation about honeybees and the lack of bees. So honey has kind of gone up. Yes. What does that mean when it comes to the use of honey here in the valley?
Well, it's a very dire situation right now. We had a huge die off this last past winter. Anywhere from 30% to 50% of the honeybees have.
Wow, that's a lot.
Yes, that's a huge die off. And actually, in today's New York Times, there is a huge article about the European Union just banned some of these pesticides that people are pointing the finger at that are causing this problem. So we're looking at that very closely here in the U.S. because at the same time, the beekeepers and environmentalists are suing the Environmental Protection Agency over these very same chemicals. These pesticides, they go into the plants. Once they are sprayed on the plants, all of the plants, the pollen, the nectar from the plant, the plant itself is all toxic. And this has a devastating effect on the bees, not only the domesticated bees, but the wild bees as well. So we're seeing a huge die-off in both realms of that. And the food that is presented, they estimate that 71 of the 100 crops that provide 90% of our food are pollinated by honeybees. So
that is huge. And, yeah. And when you think about it, you think about a process that is so natural. Here you have bees, honeybees, who make honey, you know, and how do we screw up that?
Well, we've managed quite well. The thing is, you know, you have to look at the way that we farm here, too. We create these huge monocultures. I mean, the amount of almonds that we have now growing in California, which is one of the few places that actually produces this many almonds. You know, when you have a monoculture, then that's why you have the need for pesticides, because if you have one pest that comes in, it can wipe out an entire crop, which is why the heavy reliance on these pesticides. So So we really need to find some ways to integrate more natural aspects of cover crops and, you know, facilitating the like I said, the wild and the natural and the native plants back into our system.
But what you even talked about, you know, that had a more implication was the fact that just the number, you know, the number of crops that are pollinated by bees.
Exactly. We have this mutual, you know, relationship with these bees, and we've kind of dropped our end of the bargain. They've been providing us with the pollination and the honey from all of this, you know, and of course, the production value of over $200 billion in crop value that these bees actually pollinate. And we have paid them back by, you know, pesticides, by, you know, all this and massive pesticide use. And it's just I think it's finally just reached a wall, and we really need to readdress and relook at it. So, I would encourage everybody to get involved.
At least educate yourself.
Yes,
about
it affects all of us. And also at home, well, how many pesticides are you spraying at home? How many toxic chemicals are you using in your household? So these are all issues that you really come back full circle, and you know the price of food is going up, and these are some of the issues why.
Okay, well, let's kind of talk more about the festival.
Yeah.
And it's this weekend. Is it this weekend?
Yes, it's
this weekend.
It's May 4th, and it is from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. Tickets are $5 for the food aspect of the event, the book signing, and the we'll do a storytelling of the book as well at the event at 11 o'clock. That is all free of charge, as well as the native plant sales and the honey sales. You will pay a $5 fee to get into the food tasting area.
You know, that's not bad to be able to some of those dishes that you talked about.
Oh, yes.
$5.
It's absolutely nothing. I mean, for what you get. I mean, everybody's very, very happy at this event. I mean, it's a fun event, and I encourage everybody to put on your best bee costume and come on out and buzz around with the rest of us, because there'll be a few full sized honeybees out there. For your entertainment pleasure.
No, what time is the book signing?
Signing will start probably about 8 o'clock, so that'll run all through the day. So from probably 8 o'clock to noon, you can get your book signed. For as long as the books last, they've sold out last year around 11 o'clock, so I'm hoping they've ordered a whole lot more this year.
Okay. Well, it sounds like, excuse me, a honey of an event, and something great to do this weekend. Again, Felix Muskies, Executive Director of the Vineyard Farmers Market Association. Thanks so much for coming in and talking honeybees.
Thank you.
With us. Well, that is all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kbpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us at talk@kbpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, Valley Edition producer Ezra Romero, and executive producer Joe Moore, I'm Juanita Stevenson. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.